Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com.
We've kind of got caught in, well, and there are countries around the world that are worse off than we are, but that doesn't mean we have to get into that place when it comes to our national debt. Let's just launch into it here. A lot of aspects to discuss, but we're going to focus on a couple of things with the tariff ruling and also just looking ahead to, is there a financial crisis? What would that look like? And how do we avoid that? Maya McGinnis joins us, one of the most respected, influential policy experts when it comes to finances and budget. Political independent, too, has led, worked with leaders on both parties and often published in the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. And really, Maya, thank you. Good morning. You're a fixer, right? Can you fix all this?
Good morning, and I sure am a wannabe fixer, and we can fix all this.
Yes.
There are terrible numbers out there, and there's a lot of challenges to get there, but we know how to fix it. I think the bottom line is, are we going to choose to? Are our political leaders going to choose to, and are we going to ask them to and reward them for making the real choices to do so?
Boy, when we talk about the data sets behind it, you know, that's the question that it all leads to. Are we going to have the courage to make those changes? Now, I think there's been movement, a lot of movement, actually, on Capitol Hill toward this, but we still have a debt, you know, this one big, beautiful bill. As much as we like what was in there, it's still going to add, as you guys noted, $4.2 trillion to our deficit down the road. So let's start with the hard question, and then we'll talk about some data here behind it, too. Can we? Do we have the political will? Will the American people understand and get behind it enough to force Washington to listen?
Okay, those are actually the questions at the heart of all of this. So the bottom line is, we have a terrible fiscal problem. We're borrowing $2 trillion a year just to pay our basic bills. This is not an emergency situation. This is just for when times are good and things are normal. And we know how to make those changes. You're going to have to look throughout the budget. You're going to have to reduce government spending. And in all likelihood, you're going to have to increase how much we pay to finance government through our taxes. There are lots of ways to get there. And there are lots of reasons to, because these deficits and the near record level of debt create terrible problems in terms of the economy and not just that, the national security of this country. I can go into that. But the ways to fix it are really hard. And there is no politician and there is no voter who really likes the idea of cutting spending and or raising taxes. So do we want to talk about this realistically and come to some solutions, put in real budgets that make sense? Or do we want to kind of let our politicians get away with the talking points and avoiding the topics? And the truth is, part of the reason we do that is none of us is really excited to change the budget by cutting spending or raising taxes. Those things are hard, but there's a real benefit to doing so, and we'd be so much stronger and better off in the longer run if we were willing to.
All right, we're gonna come back to this too, because this is where this path is going to lead, and hopefully, again, us as the American, the populace, and the voting populace, we're gonna have to force this action. So let's go to some of those numbers. All right, people are getting nervous about we're at now $38.739 trillion. What's the most alarming part of that? Is it the interest rates? If they go up, then you know that how much that debt costs us, or is it the fact that it's just, it could really cut off investment. It could really create this fiscal crisis that is a spiral.
Great question. I think the most alarming part is how these terrible numbers, and they're across the board, leave us vulnerable. So our debt is at near record levels. If you look at the debt as a share of the economy, which I think is important, we're almost at 106% of GDP, which is the record, which we've only had right after World War II. And we're about to be there without a world war. But there are a lot of other worrisome numbers, too, and that one is we pay $1 trillion a year in interest payments. And like you said, That's at relatively low interest rates. If interest rates go up, just by, say, 1 percentage point a year, that's going to increase those interest payments by over $300 billion every year. And I know these numbers, they don't really mean anything, right, on a personal level.
Part of the problem, yeah.
It's right. They're so big. Billions, trillions, not a household number. But interest payments on the debt run over $7,000 per household if you're breaking it out. We don't pay for them each year. We borrow more to pay for them. But the cost is huge. They're the second largest item in the federal budget that we spend more on interest payments than we do on national defense. And so I think the biggest problem is that we are now basically held hostage to the Treasury market. Are people willing to buy our debt? That's not just us. Many of us buy Treasuries when we're saving money. But it's also foreign countries. And as we've seen recently, there's been a big story that all of our non-allies around the world are buying less U.S. government debt. It's become a foreign policy tool where if they want to rattle our economy and our markets, they just have to stop buying our treasuries, and we're very dependent on it right now. That could be weaponized in many ways. It's really concerning.
What is then you talk about being hostage to the Treasury Department. Do we understand? Because there's people out there who are going to say, oh, look, it just print more money.
Right.
There's a difference right. between paper wealth and actual production wealth, and one is actual wealth.
Well, okay, so printing money, there has been a lot of talk of like, don't worry, we have the printing press. A lot of countries get into big fiscal problems because they borrow in other currencies. We are lucky we borrow in the U.S. dollar, which, because of our strong fiscal health in the past, is the reserve currency of the world. That will change if we keep borrowing too much, but that's still in the future. Right now, the problem is if you just, quote unquote, print money or you run deficits that are too large, that contributes to inflation. And we have just had a few years of really rough inflation where it's a reminder that this isn't just some macroeconomic term. This means how much you pay at the grocery store for eggs, for meat, for your rent. All of these things are affected by inflation, and that is directly affected by how much we are borrowing or printing. I think this is probably the theme. There's no easy way out of this. There's no free lunch. Whenever somebody says, don't worry, it doesn't matter, we can just borrow more, we can print money, anything that sounds too good to be true when it comes to the budget is. It's not the same as a household budget, but in many ways it is similar. You can't just wish this would disappear. You need to be able to bring in the money to pay for the things you're doing. And we have a budget where we spend $7.5 trillion a year, but we bring in $5.5 trillion. And so that difference, that $2 trillion that we plan on borrowing every year with it growing gradually, is having negative effects on how much the economy grows, on our ability to respond to future emergencies, and like we've already brought up a little bit, some of our national security as well.
So no easy way, and I appreciate that.
No easy way.
And it's hard to lead out, but that is a good lead on this discussion, and let's get to work on it. How did we get here? Go ahead.
Yeah. There's so much finger pointing in Washington. So I'm a political independent. Our organization is politically independent. What I mean by that is it's okay if you want big government or if you want small government. There's no right answer to what the government should be. But I think what is across the board true is that you should be willing to pay for what you do. But in Washington, we are so stuck with two parties spending a lot of time involved in the blame game, finger pointing. How did we get here? It's all your fault, Republican, or it's all your fault, Democrat. And neither of those is true. Since we last had budget surpluses, which was in 2001, about a third of the laws that we've passed that have deteriorated from budget surpluses to the big budget deficits we have now, about a third of them were from tax cuts, a third of them were from spending increases, and a third of them were from responding to emergencies like COVID or the Great Recession. Responding to emergencies is a good time to borrow. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Just paying your normal bills because you don't want to pay in taxes, but borrowing to do so instead, that is a really bad reason. That's been about two-thirds of it. And the interesting thing here is we did a study of this. Well over 80% of all of those policies, spending and taxes and emergencies, bipartisan. This is not one party or the other. Nobody has the mantle of pure fiscal responsibility here. If you look, and we do, we score lawmakers on how much they borrow each year. Almost every politician has engaged in borrowing at a variety of times and supported the bills that have added to the national debt. So it's been bipartisan path to get here. It also needs to be a bipartisan solution to get out of here, because these choices are hard and you need political cover. You can't expect one party to do this on their own. They're going to need to cooperate. But the first thing they should do is, if there's any pledge around all of this, it should be no new borrowing. If we're already on track to borrow over $26 trillion over the next 10 years, how about we start by promising not to make that any worse? No passing any legislation that depends on borrowing. And let's use this time to start putting in place the policies that will actually improve the situation.
You know, and that sounds like a doable kind of thing if you can start with that. And that seems like a pretty solid line to start with. And maybe a lot of people can get behind it. I want to talk, when we come on back, about what a fiscal crisis would look like. Or, as you noted, if raising taxes and cutting spending, I think a lot of people will go, with this amount of debt, that's probably a logical approach. If not, it's not going to be an easy approach. I am going to tease that Dr. Patrick Barkey is going to join us here in just a little bit. And with what you just said, I think you'll appreciate one of his lines here. It turned into one of my favorites. He's one of our top economists in the state of Montana, led the Bureau of Business and Economic Research for 17 years. But he said that the politicians often feel like when they're trying to solve a problem, they get down to the point where, oh, who's to blame? And they point the finger and then they think they've solved the problem at that point.
Yeah, that's not going to fix it.
No.
It's not going to fix it. It's also not going to unite the country. We need to work together and feel like we're one country instead of fighting between two parties.
Six scenarios we're trying to avoid here when we're looking at trying to address our overspending in this government and our national debt. We're with Maya McGinnis today, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Get some comments here about Social Security a bit later on. A crisis doesn't have to look like a crash. It can look like America slowly falling behind. That's part of, what would a financial crisis look like, that you can find writings on their website there as well. And more to it. I mean, a gradual crisis, a default crisis, an inflation crisis, just an overall financial crisis, which is kind of a collapse, which is what we're sort of worried about. I'll take a phone call here in just a bit. But Maya, thank you again for coming on. I appreciate that. We're going to hit tariffs. Nancy is lined up for that. Give me a word on these six scenarios here. And I appreciate it. I think people have to take a good, hard look at what are these consequences likely for our current spending.
Well, exactly, and thank you, because one of the challenges we have is making people understand why this issue matters to them. It's not like you see it and feel it the way you do healthcare costs or saving for retirement or all the daily economic challenges we have, but it both has an effect on the overall economy. Every day, we are actually all poorer today than we would have been if we hadn't borrowed so much in the past, and it leaves us vulnerable to a number of different crisis scenarios. So we've put out this at a financial crisis where you could have a spike in interest rates and panic among traders that would affect the entire economy. And I'm talking to folks in the markets daily and hearing they're far more concerned than they used to be. We could have an inflation crisis, which is something we had before in part, not solely, but in part because of additional borrowing too much at the time. And that's very likely to happen again if we continue to borrow the way that we are projected to. We will not get out of the current path that we're on without inflation continuing to rise instead of coming back down. There could be a crisis of the dollar where people don't want our currency anymore. That would make everything more expensive. These are all interrelated. If people don't want the U.S. dollar, inflation would be set off. Or what's really starting to become a very troubling scenario is, if our interest rates are higher than our economic growth rate, we could get into a debt spiral. And this is projected to happen in the next few years. We have no idea where the economy will be, but it looks like the expectations are that our interest rates will be higher than our growth rate. That means suddenly you have interest rates going up, your interest payments are going up, you need to borrow more to cover them. That pushes interest rates up even further, and it's really hard to pull yourself out of that. And then the last kind of scenario is, We're in a crisis right now that you can't see, touch, or necessarily feel or understand that you're feeling it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a muddling along scenario where everything's worse than it would be otherwise, and people aren't connecting that to the excessive borrowing. And so we continue on that path instead of doing the real work of adjusting our budget so that we are paying for all those things that we're spending, and we're reducing our spending, which, by the way, is growing much faster than the economy right now. And you can't have a government that continues to grow as a share of the economy without there being support to pay for it. And I don't think there is right now in this country.
Yeah.
So we need to look at controlling spending.
Yeah, and we've had that false sense of security for such a long time. I think interest rates have been a part of that as well, and our stock market too. Let's take a call real quick. Nancy out of Roundup and listening on the Mighty 790 KGHL. Thank you for waiting as well. You're on the air with Maya McGinnis.
Thank you so much for taking my phone call, and good morning. Okay, I'd like to talk about tariffs versus income tax and give just a short synopsis of the history of it in our country. And I do have a question for you this morning. Our country was always operated on using tariffs up until our Civil War broke out in 1861 when President Abraham Lincoln ratified the 16th Amendment, which gave us the income tax, because that Civil War put the Americans in debt $6.64 billion. And once again, it was February the 25th, 1913, President Woodrow Wilson ratified the 16th Amendment, giving us an income tax because of World War I. And we've been using income tax ever since. And I just want to point this out, that in 2024, income tax did provide $2.4 trillion in revenue for the American people, for our infrastructure and other necessities of our civilization. So my question is this. If we abolish the income tax, as people are discussing right now, would this place the burden of the revenue on the shoulder of we American taxpayers? And I also want to point out one more thing. Illegal immigrants have used fraud. We're seeing this in Somalians in Minnesota that have raised our debt ceiling. So this is not totally our government's fault or the taxpayers' fault. And President Trump is trying to correct this. And thank you so much. And I will listen off air to your answers.
Good job. Less than 2 minutes. Brought the receipts, too. Nancy, appreciate that. Maya.
Thank you. I love that question. I love that history lesson. And there are books out there that are so interesting on the history of the income tax and the history of the debt in this country. And it sounds like you've read them. So we share that interest. Listen, one of the issues I think is that we could abolish the income tax, but it raises such a significant amount of money. I think in some ways we are all, as taxpayers and burden taxpayers, in search for getting away from the obligation of taxation. And it can't be done. Even if you raise all the money from corporations, excuse me,
right,
that still comes back to the cost of either you as a worker, you as a shareholder, or you as a consumer. All of these taxes end up being borne. The cost of it is borne on us. It just depends in what way. It may be directly of you writing a check. It may be at the counter when you're paying your sales tax. Or it may be through a tariff or a corporate tax, which ends up pushing up the prices of other goods. So it's not as though, again, there's no free lunch here. I think tariffs themselves are really interesting. As we know, a big chunk of them were just found illegal. But it seems as though the administration may find other ways to collect that tariff revenue, relying on different laws. Tariffs I look at as serving three purposes, and you can like them or not like them. One is foreign policy. How do we break a dependence on purchasing goods from countries with whom we're not aligned? China is the perfect example, and it makes sense, I think, to run through, do you want to be dependent on a country that you are having huge tensions with for goods that you need? And I think I would say there is a sensible reason to make sure you're not reliant on countries who don't have your best interest at heart. There's then the economic effect. They're not great for the economy. They lead to inflation, higher prices, and they slow the growth of the economy. So do most taxes. So you have to evaluate whether they're better or worse than the alternative. And then finally, from the fiscal stance, where I spent a lot of my time looking, these tariffs have been incredibly useful in that they are raising $2.5 trillion We have very few things that are increasing the revenue coming into the government, and tariffs have been effective in doing that. So the loss of the money from the IEEPA ruling, from the Supreme Court change, means we're going to lose a lot of that revenue. We need to think about ways to replace it. So lots of different taxes. I happen to think a blend of them is the right way to go, because a lower rate on any single thing is good for the better for the economy. But it's a really thoughtful question. There are lots of ways to raise that revenue. We don't love any of them. We can't pretend that it's not us paying these things, but we do have to if we want the government to provide those goods. Also, your question on waste, fraud, and abuse, really, really important. There are a lot of excess costs, waste in the government. Some fraud, less than waste, I'd say, but there's both. We need to go through the federal government, I'd especially say in the areas of health care and national security procurement, defense procurement. There's so many ways to save money, but I also want to be realistic. We hear about this all the time. It's very hard to ferret out this waste, because one person's waste is somebody else's profit. Now, scamming government programs, that's a no-brainer. That's an easy one. But there's nowhere close to enough money to fix this fiscal situation. So again, I don't want us to hide behind, okay, if we just get rid of all the scams out there, our budget will be balanced. It's not going to get us close at all. Pennies on the dollar. Let's go after it all. But let's also be realistic on, if we want the programs we have, we're going to have to figure out how we pay for them. And we certainly need to find ways to scale back that overall spending, waste, and also programs that we might like, but we just have become too expensive.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I'm glad we got into that as well. We were maybe going to put Social Security on the plate. Don't have time for it. I've got about a minute here, full minute. What's your final thoughts here? Tell us we can do this, Maya.
We can do this. Yes. We can do this. There's lots of solutions, and many people know them. And in fact, the policies aren't the hard part. The politics is the hard part. So one thing is, we should probably appoint a fiscal commission, a bunch of experts and a bunch of our political leaders, where they spend time working on this issue together, come up with some solutions that we know where they are. We need to look at, we certainly need to save Social Security. It's going to be insolvent in 6 years. We need to do something there. We need to control healthcare costs. We need to make sure that our defense is done efficiently. And we need to probably get rid of the $25 trillion in tax breaks we have. That's a great start, but it's hard. So maybe a commission where it gives some political cover and we know it will be bipartisan, I think that's a great start. There are a lot of members of Congress who support that. That's where I would start. And at the same time, we're coming up with a, in case of emergency, break glass plan. So if we do have one of those fiscal crises, we better be ready with a plan.
Maya McGinnis.
We're working on that.
I'm going to be out of time here, but we are having you back, okay? Thanks for the great work. It is Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
The fastest hour in Montana radio continues. Call 866-627-5483 and join Montana's statewide radio talk show, Voices of Montana with Tom Schultz.
Boy, America is drinking heavily, borrowing heavily during relatively calm times, as we just heard from Maya McGinnis here from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. I'm telling you, there's a lot of really good stuff in there, and they're not just throwing stuff out. This is backed up information here. But we have got some things to do here when it comes to our national debt, and how do we kind of get out of that? We want to kind of look more toward this tariff ruling, and how that might impact Montana. I think housing, obviously, we're looking at a lot of housing fixes in this state. How does that impact our economy? How does our debt affect Montana? And for that, we are going to have Montana's economist on the air to talk about, Dr. Patrick Barkey, former executive director for the Bureau of Business and Economic Research there for a lot of years, and now does our Montana Economic Minute, as well as he's retired from the BBER. But good to hear from you, Patrick. Thank you so much for coming on. I'll still call you Dr. Barkey because it makes your brother mad.
That's right, Tom. And good morning. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for coming on here. What's your assessment? I mean, we just kind of went around a little bit with Maya McGinnis here. I think some of the takeaways there are, when you look at solutions, no easy way, right? Increased taxes, cutting spending, probably some type of combination of that, if we can even get serious about our spending and our deficit. You've been around the game a little bit, Patrick. What are your thoughts here nowadays?
Well, I mean, there's several thoughts that come to my mind, Tom. The old saying, you know, when you're in a hole, the first rule is to stop digging.
Yeah.
And we're certainly not following that. I think one of the real tragedies of the deficit situation is that our leadership, and for that I would blame us, as I look in the mirror at myself, and everyone listening should probably blame a little bit of themselves as well, because we're the ones that voted these people all into office, whichever party they're in. But our leadership has not really set the table and caused us to actually understand why spending is on such a runaway course. So we really don't understand, for example, why, to take a specific example, Medicare spending is set to double in the next 10 years. Okay. We don't seem to have an understanding of that. We have this primitive idea that we don't want Medicare to change. And yet when you're on that kind of course, you have to change. And somebody, of course, the person that stands up and says it gets shut down, but nonetheless, to begin to actually elevate the conversation to one where we start to understand that, yes, we're in a difficult situation, and yes, something needs to change, and here's why, and start talking about those solutions, even if we don't like any of them. You know, when something that big, it's spending over $1 trillion to set the double, you know, even for the federal government, that's a big deal.
And in the circles that you walk in, that, you know, give us that sense of confidence that the work that you guys do, you present a lot of the facts out there, there's solutions behind that. What is your sense that the American people are going to move the ball forward, or that Washington, D.C. is going to get responsible about this before a crisis happens? And maybe we're already seeing a crisis happen.
No, I don't think we're seeing the crisis happen, okay. But when we see the crisis, we'll all know it, because it'll you know, it's going to be a big balloon that pops, but it's not really clear exactly when or in our lifetimes or anything like that. But meanwhile, we do have an issue, and I think I guess I lost my train of thought there, Tom, but I think the issue involved is going to involve some people talking about solutions. I mean, the nice thing about all these problems is they're all solvable.
Yes.
What we have, though, and not just in this country, but it's very apparent in this country, is we have an entitlement system that is not sustainable given our demographics. Now that I've joined the ranks of the retired, there's a lot of people in those ranks with me, and those fractions are very large. And, there's a system that's been set up that's been running here since the 30s that where the federal government, I mean, the primary thing that the federal government does, when I say do, I don't mean speeches and tweets and all that thing, but in terms of dollars. The primary thing that the federal government does today and has done for quite a number of years is to spread money from the working age people to the retired people. That's exactly what the federal government does in terms of money. It dwarfs everything else.
Mm. And wealth distribution is one of those things that government does that we don't talk about enough here. What's your take on the tariff ruling? I'm not surprised at this. And by the way, everybody, Rob Nadelson, Professor Nadelson, worked at the University of Montana there, where Dr. Patrick Barkey, 17 years at BBER. He's going to be on the show on Monday. His work was cited by Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, in Thomas's dissent of the majority ruling, although Professor Nadelson says that he agrees with the majority, but not necessarily for the reason that the majority drew. Anyway, that's coming up, and we'll have more on that aspect of it on Monday. What's your take, though, right off bat there, Patrick?
Well, right off the bat, the legality of it is outside my pay range. So I come from a family of lawyers, but I'm not one myself, and so I could not tell you whether the legal basis for the decision made sense or didn't make sense. But what I do know is that it was certainly a big, it was an anticipated ruling. And what it does right now is it raises a level of uncertainty. It's the perfect time for the president, in my opinion, to stand down and cool it for a little while. But that's not his style, and hats off to him. He is who he is. But the upshot is that it's raised the uncertainty of trade policy, which is poisonous to risk-taking and future-looking investment.
Yeah, and I think we've seen some impact from that as well. AI has a huge impact, too, on our economy, and that's something to talk about. I just read that there was this Block organization. It's kind of a software developing. They're letting go of half of their, almost half of their workforce, and he says everybody's expected to get there at some point as well. So that's a whole new scenario to kind of address. Let's take a call, though. Chris has been standing by, listening. Love our folk there in Kalispell, and he's listening in Columbia Falls, KOFI 1180 AM and 104.3 FM. Some comments, Chris. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. In the day back here, 1991, I read a book, Government Waste Racket Washington from A to Z. Martin Close wrote that book, and if we had followed that, the debt back then in 1991 was over $3 trillion. $3 trillion. Now, this isn't chicken feed. But when your outgo exceeds your income, your upkeep's your downfall. And that's the pattern that we're locked into. And we just don't seem to understand that and to get out of it. So that's the real problem. Martin simply stated our government is presently too big and unresponsive to make a 180-degree change. Mm. The federal apparatus is so big. And he said Congress, the presidency has locked itself into a pattern of failure. He wrote this in 1991. If we had a breakout, he said, this is a warning, we must restructure the federal government.
Chris,
we have strayed too far from the design that the founding fathers portrayed us.
I appreciate that. I'm gonna throw that to you, to Dr. Barkey here about the mechanism for getting right sized again. If we're spending, we're spending $7 trillion, we're earning $5 trillion, so we're borrowing $2 trillion. If you either raise taxes or cut services to make up that figure, what does that look like?
Well, I mean, you mix together a lot of topics in terms of waste, efficiency. There's lots of comments to be made there.
Mm-hmm.
I would turn this a little bit, the same thing I just said about entitlement programs. You need to understand what the problem is. I think with respect to the political aspects of deficit spending, we need to understand what the problem is. And that is, quite simply, it's been a tremendous success for politicians. If you look at the reelection rate for people in Congress, it's sky high. I mean, we are not throwing the bums out, so to speak, okay? Mm. We're reelecting them. In fact, we're tormenting anyone that suggests cutting anything. So from a political point of view, that's the problem. I mean, the problem is that there is no political penalty really being paid for rising levels of deficit spending. And, of course, what's happened in the last 15 years or so is that we have gone from relative stability in terms of the deficits relative to the economy to deficits relative to the economy that forget about World War II. I mean, these are way past World War II levels and rising more because of demographics. So we need to understand, I don't know about restructuring in America and all that sort of thing, because, that throws open, you talk about uncertainty with tariff policy, that would be uncertainty all over the place. I think we have the mechanisms to correct this problem, and we certainly have the smarts to do it, but you need to recognize what the political problem is, and that is there's no penalty to these folks for deficit spending. It's done by both parties.
It's a failure.
It's done by Congress, it's the way it is.
Failure.
And, they're responding to the incentives.
A failure of the media, I think. A failure of the public overall as well. And certainly a failure of our politicians. Montana's economist, Dr. Patrick Barkey, with us here today. We talk about our economy an awful lot. I want to note for our affiliates, we do have an afternoon financial report that Cody Ross, our engineer here, does a great job with. There's the Montana Economic Minute that's available as well, and that is produced by, I'd like to call it Barkey Unleashed, because now that he's retired, there's the filter kind of goes away a little bit, doesn't it, Patrick?
I don't know if there ever was one.
Yeah, okay, yeah, good answer. I heard one recently about housing, and we just got a couple of minutes here left here. So, you know, from your perspective, and you've been talking about housing a lot, the BBER has done a lot of work on that too. Are we making progress?
Well, that's there's a lot to be said about housing. There's some things that are moving fairly slowly, but in a favorable direction. Quietly, not fast enough for some. Montana housing markets are getting a lot more normal.
Oh,
the big
good.
Spigot of migration from out of state is gone. We're back to pre-COVID levels, if that, of folks moving here from other states. Interest rates have crept down just a tiny bit, but I think what has happened is that you've seen more of a balanced market even in the faster-growing areas of the state, which have been impacted. The problem is affordability is only a little bit better.
Right.
And this is probably the way housing affordability is going to be solved. It takes years for income growth to catch up with the giant galloping forward of housing prices that occurred immediately after COVID. Those who expected those prices to come right back down to levels we all like are going to find their hopes dashed, because that's not the way recovery is going to work out. There's some favorable demographic things happening with housing, but I don't know if I have enough time to get all that in. But suffice it to say that the hand-wringing over the fact that younger people can no longer afford homes and get in the housing market is still true for a lot of younger people, but not as many as it was a couple years ago. And that's, I would argue, a good thing. The fly in the ointment, of course, is who knows what the policymakers are going to do, okay? So there's been talk about some very drastic change, especially at the federal level, to housing policy. Tons of pressure to lower interest rates. If we get a little carried away and start loaning money to people who don't have the capacity to pay it back, we could be looking at another Great Recession-type scenario where we had subprime mortgages go belly up and the economy did not fare very well. Let's hope we learn that lesson. But I'm cautiously optimistic about housing is the way I would put it, Tom.
Do you have a 10-second response to regulatory changes? Have they helped at the state level?
They've helped a little bit. They've raised awareness, and they have made even the more restrictive parts of the state pay attention to what they're doing that impacts markets.
Great to catch up with you, Patrick. I hope you're well, and I hope you're having some fun. And look for that Montana Economic Minute. Lots of great stuff in there.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.